Affairs Committee to order, and I'm going to open a work session for a possible reconsideration of House Bill 2717, Representative Schoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having voted on the prevailing side, I move the rules to be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2717.
Representative Schoffler moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on 2717. Is there any objection? Need an explanation of why.
You want to do that?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2717 passed out of committee on March 30th. Representative Gilman was excused, but the rest of you voted aye. It's the one that requires a postponed workers' compensation hearing to be held no later than 120 days from the original hearing date. The bill does have a fiscal impact, and it's the chair, one of the co-chairs of the Ways and Means Committee, and the staff there are trying to determine whether it needs to have a Ways and Means referral. We did not have a Ways and Means referral on the bill, so that's still under discussion, and that's the reason for the possible reconsideration.
We're stuck in neutral. So. Okay, is there any objection to Representative Schoffler's motion to suspend the rules? Seeing none, they're suspended. Representative Schoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2717.
Representative Schoffler moves we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2717. Is there any objection? If not, so ordered. We're done. Okay. Third thing?
Mm-hmm. Okay, you're fine.
Without objection. Huh?
Okay.
Should we start with the 18? Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2718. And Janet, can you give us a rundown on the bill?
Pardon? Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2718 allows a public utility with assets of more than $500 million to obtain excess workers' compensation insurance coverage from a surplus lines carrier. Mr. Chair, this applies to Northwest Natural, and the bill was requested by them and introduced by this committee. Mr. Chair, Gary Bauer is here and can explain the purpose of the bill.
Gary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. Appreciate the opportunity to appear this morning in support of House Bill 2718. Northwest Natural is a self-insured employer providing utility services here in Oregon. We serve about 550,000 customers. Under current law, a self-insured employer is required to have excess insurance coverage appropriate for its potential liability. And we do that. We requested House Bill 2718 because we have a concern about being able to continue to receive and acquire this level of insurance. The market for excess insurance provided to utilities is limited, from what I'm told by our brokers who go out and look for this insurance. We do buy from an insurer that's authorized to do business in Oregon today. That insurer, however, tells us regularly for the last few years that they are not sure whether they're going to keep providing that insurance. So what this would do would be, if at some point in the future it's necessary for us to look elsewhere, we would be able to buy insurance from a surplus lines carrier. The legislation, when we discussed this with the workers' comp division with Mr. Schultz, among the issues he asked is, you know, how can you kind of limit this so that we make sure you've got employers that will be solvent as you go forward, as well as if you do end up going to a surplus lines carrier, that they also would be solvent. So that's why we narrowed it very specifically to utilities. These utilities are those that are regulated by the Public Utility Commission, and they are very large utilities. A utility cannot pick up and leave the state. We cannot sell our assets. We cannot change ownership in the company without approval from the Public Utility Commission. So it's not as if at some point in the future we might just fade off into the woodwork or disappear. And in terms of making sure that a surplus lines carrier is stable, The Workers' Comp Division does have the ability to adopt rules requiring that you use a surplus lines carrier that has an AM Best rating of a certain level or something like that. And it's my understanding that if this passes, they will probably look at doing that. Would appreciate your support of the bill. Thank you.
Any questions? I don't see any, Gary. They must understand it thoroughly.
Thank you.
Do we have is there a last one? Is there anyone here that wants to testify on House Bill 2718? Don't see any, huh? None. Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2718 and open a work session on House Bill 2718. Representative Shields.
Mr. Chair, I move we move House Bill 2718 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Shields moves House Bill 2718 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I believe this, well, I'm sure that this bill was passed and reviewed by the MLAC group and got its blessing, so.
Mr. Chair.
Right.
He decided.
Gary Bauer, Northwest National. I apologize. It's MLAC did not review the bill. It was scheduled. They ran out of time. They then looked at it and decided that it didn't really fall in their purview.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
Is there any other discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
Representative Rascal.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Kicks.
Excuse.
Representative Shoffman.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Chair Brewer.
Aye. Motion carries. Put it on the consent calendar, can we?
Yeah, I'll make that motion.
Representative Shoffman moves that House Bill 2718.
Representative Shields did.
Okay, Representative Shields.
All right.
Did you move and place it on the consent? Representative Shields moves that we place House Bill 2718 on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's there. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2740. Janet, can you give us a rundown, please?
I need a hold over on this. Okay,
yes, you want to talk to me? I opened the hearing house on you.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2740 modifies the definition of a vehicle broker to clarify that interest in the vehicle does not transfer to the broker during the transaction. There are a number of other provisions in the original bill, but you should have the dash 3 amendments at your place, and they replace the original bill. Mr. Chair, they define brokerage service as arranging for a buyer or lessee to obtain a vehicle that does not include consignment, exchanges within one franchise, or receiving a referral fee from another dealer. Mr. Chair, it also defines the broker. It adds to existing disclosure requirements and makes it required that clear and conspicuous notice to the buyer or lessee if the broker adds a fee to the purchase price that has been negotiated with the seller or lessor. There's another number of provisions that relate to what a broker may not do, and those are listed in the staff measure summary. Mr. Chair, again, you should have the dash 3 amendments, and this bill has a referral to the Transportation Committee that was a mistaken referral, and the speaker has asked us, and we have gotten permission to
extend
that referral if the committee so desires. Thank you.
Okay, could I have Sean Miller and Larry Campbell, please? Oh, yeah, I see that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sean Miller. I'm here today representing the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. To my right is Jose Pino Mesa, the first vice president of the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. We are here in support of House Bill 2740 and the Dash 3 amendments, which you have before you. The Dash 3 amendments, as Janet indicated, essentially replace the existing bill. The bill is a consumer protection bill that has been brought to you by the industry as we worked with the Department of Justice in actually crafting the language. The three provisions within the bill, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that we introduced the bill to get at was to deal with provisions that deal with broker compensation disclosure requirements that are currently not in the statute. We also, the bill is creates a bright line between the broker and a auto dealer business relationship and activities between those two. And finally, the third provision is dealing with false advertising. And again, that particular provision connects to the broker disclosure and compensation that is not in the statute. House Bill 2740 is designed to create transparency and require disclosure in brokering transactions for the consumer. Under the bill and the Dash 3 amendments, auto brokers would be required to disclose in writing a description of the fees the broker will charge for their service. The bill would also, again, prohibit the representing that the service is free. And finally, Mr. Chair, it would prohibit an auto dealer from representing him or herself as a broker if they sell a vehicle from their own inventory. And that's one of the issues that, again, was not in current statute, and many dealers that are brokers have their own inventory, and it's an issue that it's taken a long time and negotiation with the Department of Justice, and I know they're going to be following our testimony to explain that process as well. But that was that's a primary component of this particular bill, because as a customer coming into a dealership, if you're representing the interests of that consumer as a broker and decide to at some point sell a vehicle from your own inventory, your relationship has changed with that consumer. And therefore, we wanted to create that bright line within the statute, the disclosure requirements. And again, it's allowing the consumer to understand the transaction and make the proper decision. At that point, if they don't want that relationship, they can leave and obviously find another relationship with another auto dealer, another broker. The bill, again, the current statute does not provide any of these provisions. And I think this is a responsible bill brought to you by the industry as well as the Department of Justice in for consumer protection. Again, if there's any questions, I would be happy to answer. I know, again, the Department of Justice will be following as well, and Jose Pino Mesa, who was a part of that work, can answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Jose?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jose Pino Mesa. I'm the first vice president of the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association, which currently we have about 850 members. Many of our members are brokers as well, and this is something that we think is very important, and we stand behind it 100%. So if you have any questions, please let me know. Thank you.
Thank you, Jose. Larry?
Chair Brown and members of the committee, I'm Larry Campbell, representing AAA Oregon, Idaho, and our 624,000 members. We support House Bill 2740, but that's not the reason I want to take a couple of minutes of your time today. What I want to do is complement the process of compromise in reaching language that all of the players could buy into. The concepts identified with this issue inception was very controversial. There was a great deal of disagreement when this process started. The hours of meeting between the interested parties were both positive and fruitful, resulting in a unanimous support for the final legislation of those that were involved. I particularly want to recognize the efforts of Eugene Ebersole and Cheryl Pellegrini, representing the Department of Justice, and their contribution in working toward a positive solution. We would like to ask that this legislation move today to the floor of the House of Representatives with a do-pass recommendation. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Larry. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could I have Monty King and Daryl Fuller, please?
We are on 2740.
We do 2718.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Monty King. I'm the president of the Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association. House Bill 2740 is about honesty and integrity in the automotive sales industry. This bill and the Dash 3 amendments crafted by all of the industry is a good bill, and I'm proud to be part of the solution. I want to compliment the Attorney General and her staff for working with the industry. I've been dealing with this since the beginning of last year, when I was writing articles back then, and there were a few people who didn't like what I had to say. I think this bill gets to the problem. It handles what's going to happen in the future. Basically, if dealers acting as a broker, and in some way they advertise that they are a broker, whether it's on their website, if it's on their paperwork, if it's on their sign outside the door, if they say broker in their advertising, or if they just say, I'm going to get you the best deal possible, now they're a broker. And then this stuff starts to kick in. So no longer will somebody be able to put broker on their sign and on their ads and whatever, and on their website, and then sell something from an inventory without telling the people that they're not going to represent them anymore. But can a person still come into the dealership and say, hey, can you get me an 85 Chevy? Sure, and you don't have to be a broker to get to that point. Because the dealer hasn't said, I'm going to give you the best deal. They don't have a broker on their sign. They didn't have it on their advertising or anything else. And the dealer goes down maybe to the auction or someplace, and he buys that vehicle and he brings it back to the lot and he says, okay, there it is. It's this much money. They're not a broker because they haven't said that they're going to represent them in a deal. They haven't said they're going to get them the best deal. They've gone out and bought the vehicle. They've taken a chance. And if the person doesn't like the vehicle, they don't have to buy it. And the dealer's going to get stuck with it. So there is a line there. I don't know how bright it is, but there is a line there. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have written testimony today. There's something in the record about where that line is. Because customers still want dealers to help them find a vehicle. They don't necessarily want them to represent them in getting the best deal. They want to make a decision when they get to where the price is. I think the price is a very important part of this. But the advertising, the signage, those are things that are very, very important. And the other part is products. When a car dealer sells a vehicle, he's selling a product. When he's acting as a broker, he's selling a service. When he's selling a warranty, he's selling a product. So a broker can also sell a product as well as selling a service. And when you're selling products, if you're in business, you don't want to have to tell somebody how much you're making on a product. So the product line is important, and the service line is important. And I think in my written testimony, I've kind of laid that out. I would encourage you to read it. The other part of the price being important to the customer, there's one aspect of the bill where if a broker goes out and said, okay, I found you the car, it's $23,000, this is the price, and I am going to, not you, the $23,000. The price is $23,000, and the selling dealer is going to pay me my fee from that. Do you want to buy the car? Now, the customer can still say, how much are you getting? Dealer can either say, well, you know, tell them the truth, and it has to be the whole truth, because you can't lie under the Unfair Trade Practices Act, I understand. You have to either tell them the truth or stop acting as the broker and let the car go and let them go someplace else. So that no matter what, even though the price is in the price, the fee is included in the price, they can't get another fee. They can get it as part of the price, but the customer could still ask to know what it is if they really want to. Most people just want to know what the price is. If the price is good, go. Thank you. Thank you, Bonnie. Daryl?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Daryl Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. We were a party to the talks that ended in the great compromise of 2005, and I want to let you know that the Oregon Auto Dealers Association supports it. I had prepared some written testimony last night with the motif of the lion laying down with the lamb, and was pretty happy with myself when I went to bed last night. I got up this morning and looked at it and thought, If I submit this testimony, I'm going to start a huge fight because you have Larry Campbell and Sean Miller over here and Cheryl Pellegrini and Gene Ebersole over here, and nobody's going to want to be the lamb. Everybody's going to argue.
Where am I?
And so I decided to just disband with my written testimony and let you know that the lions have laid down with the lions and that we have a compromise that everybody can support.
Thank you, dear.
Mr. Chair, I thought it was the lambs and the lambs.
Well, let me explain this again, Representative Schaffler.
Is there any questions? Seeing none. Cheryl Pellegrini, please.
Salary from it, making money. It's not the company. These people don't have a dime coming in.
Maybe you can take it to $2,000.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I get the bat cleanup here. Again, I just would like to reiterate just briefly what other witnesses have said, that this the Dash 3 amendments do represent a concerted effort by the Department of Justice and the industry to clarify the role that brokers play as agents for buyers, or representatives for buyers, and to articulate the duties owed by a broker to their customer, the buyer. And I can say that we really, this does represent we are, I think, now of a single mind about this, and we've come a long way from the start of the process. And I would compliment everybody as well, including Eva Tayros from our office, who wasn't mentioned, but actually kept this entire process moving. Just very briefly, I'd just like to highlight how the bill works, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them for you. As others have stated, what we have done is we have essentially revamped the entire broker provisions in order to reflect a change in the industry. I think when brokers first started offering their services in the early 90s, practice then was for a broker to collect a fee up front in advance of providing the service. And the problem that the statute then was designed to address is that there were brokers who were collecting fees for services and then not providing the services and leaving. Well, the industry has evolved from that point to this, and it is now more the common practice where a broker will not collect an upfront fee, but will collect their fee at the other end of the transaction by adding the amount that they will charge onto the purchase price of the vehicle, so that the consumer, instead of writing two checks, really just writes one check, goes over to the dealer to pay the full purchase price of the car plus the added-on broker fee, and then the broker is paid out of that amount by the dealer. And so what the Dash 3 amendments do is they reflect that shift in the industry, and they set out disclosure requirements so that buyers are clear about how fees are being paid and at what point during the transaction they're being paid. And then also to deal with the second issue that was raised by the prior witnesses, and that is that because in Oregon, brokers, to operate at all, must be licensed as motor vehicle dealers, there are circumstances in which a broker may also have what we would call a dealer inventory, a stock of vehicles that they keep, out of which they may desire to sell a particular vehicle to someone who comes in seeking their services. And so there has been some confusion among consumers who would initially engage the services of a broker, and after the broker began to provide services, they would get to a point and the broker would realize that they actually had the car in their own inventory, and then would seek to step out of that broker relationship and into a dealer relationship to sell the consumer that car. And, of course, the significant point here is that when a person shifts as acting as a broker, which is an agent acting on behalf of the buyer for the buyer's benefit, to acting as a dealer, they are switching from an agency relationship to one in which they would deal at arm's length with a buyer, and with whom a buyer would then be free to negotiate for the best price possible on their own behalf. And so the Dash 3 amendments are really designed to create disclosures to inform buyers as they get into the transaction very early on, one, about the particular role that a broker is playing, about the particular services a buyer can expect to receive from a broker if they engage the broker services, and a clear disclosure if at any point during the transaction the broker seeks to change their relationship with the buyer to, from a broker to a dealer in order to engage in an arm's length sale of a car. So that's essentially what these do. You've heard a lot about them. I'm happy to go through them with you quickly if you'd like to just hear a little bit about the particular provisions.
Okay,
or
go ahead.
Stop.
All right. Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. The fee being charged by the broker does not go to the government. That's a fee for service that goes to the private broker, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffer, that is correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Cheryl? Don't see any.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Let's see. Was there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2740? Seeing none, we'll close the hearing on 2740 and open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2740 to. Is that Ways and Means referral?
Excuse me.
I would like, Mr. Chair, rescind the referral to Ways and Means for House Bill 2740.
Rescind.
And. Refer it to transportation.
No. Representative Schaffer moves.
How about the Dash 3? How about the Dash 3?
What are we rescinding?
We're rescinding the motion to.
I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2740.
Okay. Representative Schaffer moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2740.
Strenuously.
Is there any objection?
Mr. Chair, I move we rescind the referral to transportation, House Bill 2740.
Representative Schaffler moves that we rescind the referral to the Committee on Transportation.
I move, Mr. Chair.
Oh, wait a minute. I have a little discussion on that.
Okay.
I think it's an excellent idea. We've gone over this bill adequately, and there's no need for transportation to look at it.
Thank you,
Representative Gimmon. Thank you for your discussion on that matter.
It's rescinded. Representative Schaffler.
Motion to the floor, Mr.
Chair. Send it to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2740 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Schaffler moves House Bill 2740 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitt.
Aye.
Representative
Schaffler. Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Excuse? Aye. Motion carries. Need a carrier? Representative Schaffler will carry the bill on the floor.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you, sir. Okay, we're going to. Committee will. House Bill 2958 will be carried over. And so we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3272. Janet?
That's mine. I haven't got to read it yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3272 was introduced. Excuse me. At the request of the American Council of Engineering Companies and the American Institute of Architects, and was introduced by this committee. It would require local public contracting agencies to select architectural, engineering, and land surveying services on the basis of qualifications, regardless of the size of the contract or the financial participation by the state. It allows the local agency to consider price information for such services only after the agency has selected the candidate or firm. It does allow termination of the selection if reasonable compensation, as determined by the agency, cannot be negotiated. Mr. Chair, deletes a 2008 sunset on current requirements that local governments use qualifications-based selection for projects over $400,000 with at least 35% state funding. So, Mr. Chair, under current law, state public works projects are required to be for architectural engineering and land surveying services are required to be done by the QBS method, qualified base selection. But local contracts do not have to be, are not required to be based on QBS selection, but they're allowed to be. The exception is for projects that are over $400,000 at the local level that have at least 35% state participation, and those are required to be bid QBS. Mr. Chair, the change is not real obvious in the bill, but it's the on lines 9, 7, and 9 is where the word state is taken out. So the requirement now applies to the state contracting agencies, and the amendment, the bill would apply it to local contracting agencies as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet.
And there are, excuse me, Mr. Chair, there are some letters that were at your place this morning, and I know you may have received some of these yourself, but these were the ones that we were.
Thank you, Janet. Marshall?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon in support of House Bill 3272. Janet did a great job of going over the bill and what it does. One thing I would like to do is we fully understand there is no work session today, but what we'd really like to do is to make sure that you're very comfortable with the policy. This is a something that the state of Oregon is doing, and I know there's a lot of questions and confusion about this issue. We just want to make sure we've got some great experts here in the room today, and at the end of the day, hopefully you're very comfortable with the policy. We appreciate this opportunity to present our position on this important question for the state. We strongly support the expansion of QBS in Oregon. It has become the model procurement method for professional design services across the country and is a proven procurement method. The expansion of QBS to more public works projects in Oregon will ensure better projects through the design and construction phase as well as the operation and maintenance life cycle of the project. I'm going to make some opening comments, and then we've got three or four people, engineers, and then an architect or two to make some comments about the bill. My comments are four pages. I'm going to summarize that so we can get to the engineers. QBS is a competitive procurement process in which engineering firms submit qualifications to the procuring agency. The owner assesses the expertise, so the owner would be the government, the local government, or the state government, assesses the expertise and other relevant important qualifications. The most qualified firm is determined by the procuring agency, is selected to negotiate the project scope and associated fee. It's important to understand that all aspects of this process are totally in control of the agency that is looking to procure an engineer or architect or land surveyor. The control of defining qualifications, scoring responses, finalizing the scope of the project, and negotiating the final budget is always and completely in control of the owner or agency. Our witnesses will discuss this further. The second page, it shows the policy statement of two key organizations. I won't read those, but the American Bar Association has a strong policy in support of QBS, and the American Public Works Association has a strong policy in support of QBS. And I'm thrilled today to know that we have somebody here from the APWA in Oregon who will speak very clearly on the QBS process. QBS does not, what it doesn't do is eliminate local control. Matter of fact, this is not a one-size-fits-all requirement or procurement method. All control of the process is in the agency hands, from drafting the request for qualifications to ranking the responses to negotiating the price. At no time is the design professional calling the shots. It does not increase project cost. Studies show QBS, because of the cooperative attitude it creates between the agency and the design professional, is more effective through the design and construction process, and then any innovation that is developed through that cooperative process will save money during the life cycle of the project and maintenance and operational costs. QBS does not alter bidding of the construction phase. This has nothing to do with the construction phase and the long-standing process of going out to bid on construction. This is the design, the important design phase before the construction bid is begun. Why use QBS? The importance of QBS cannot be overstated. Every project is unique with its own technical challenges, and at the outset of most projects, it is sometimes difficult for the owner to fully grasp the complexities of the project or the variety of professional services that may be required to develop a solution. The qualified design professional fills these needs for the owner. The design professional serves as the agent of the owner, representing the owner's interest in day-to-day dealings with contractors, suppliers, equipment manufacturers, and others providing goods and services for the project. For this reason, it is vital that the owner and the design professional share a relationship characterized by trust, respect, and effective communication. QBS has proven to foster this relationship by bringing the owner and the design professional together as a team. The history on this in Oregon, QBS is not a new issue, and I think we've made that clear in some of the discussions we've had. In 1972, the U.S. Congress passed the Brooks Act requiring this process for all federal agencies. In 97, Oregon passed legislation requiring QBS to be used by all state agencies, and as Janet went over, in 2001, we passed a bill requiring QBS for local governments where certain thresholds are met. Now, 45 states have some sort of a QBS requirement. This is not a new grand experiment, but a proven and respected process for ensuring the best use of public funds and at the same time perfecting the health and safety of all Oregonians. We have worked closely with local government folks over the years and on the benefits of QBS, and several years ago we worked with them on a consultant selection manual that was jointly created with QBS included as an option for them to consider. However, we have had limited support from Oregon's local governments to use QBS. We do, however, appreciate those that are using it, and many do. Our legislation will bring uniformity across the state to the critical design phase of more public works projects. And that's really the reason for the bill. We've worked with them. We continue to attend a lot of meetings. We educate. We go to annual meetings. There we continue to see projects that have price and bidding as a significant portion of the selection process. Education commitment, and I'll stop after this. If we're successful, and one of the commitments we've made is a continuing education process with local governments. We need educated public owners to work with us through this process. These are our clients, and it's important that they understand and appreciate how QBS is beneficial to their limited and valuable public works funds. Our commitment to education is real and a pledge we will not back away from. If they are not comfortable with QBS, we are no better off than we are today. With that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoenfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very much inclined to support this idea. There's a few things I want to be discussed here today, though. And I'm a small contractor myself, and I know for a fact I've went and had to tear out low-bid stuff and replace it. And I tell folks, if you pick me, I'm not the lowest. I may not be the lowest, but I know you'll get what you paid for the first time. And it also holds true for project labor agreements for contractors that are signatory with unions in general on big government projects. I just wanted to throw that in there, too. Someday I hope we have that conversation here. But there are some concerns, some very nice people that I have great respect for about this, and I want their concerns addressed this morning, and as long as we have this conversation. In the testimony, one of your clients says, when architectural and engineering services are selected based on low bid, quality suffers and costs rise. I want that addressed. There's also this concern that costs will trend upward due to what some consider a lack of competition, and also another concern that I've heard that small firms will be pushed out, they will not be able to continue in business, they will not be able to get into business. I would like those things, and I'll gladly repeat them as people come up if necessary. I want those things addressed today, if you would, please. And your clients, please.
Did you get those all down, Marshall?
Chair Brown, Representative Schoffler,
I didn't.
We'd be pleased to answer those, and I've said to many of you already, if we're not able to answer those questions, then we don't deserve this legislation. I think we can meet and make you comfortable with all those questions. Thank you. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dave Leonard from Pinnacle Engineering from Roseburg.
Good morning, Chair Brown and members of the committee. I'm Dave Leonard. I'm a registered civil and structural engineer, and I own one of the small firms that prefers to do business by qualified or on a qualifications basis. Our firm was established in 1984 in Colorado with a six-year hiatus after selling a company in Phoenix. I moved to Oregon and due to a non-compete agreement worked as public works director for Douglas County for that six-year period. At the expiration of my non-compete, I went back into business, and the business is doing very well. My firm provides structural engineering, geotechnical, or soils engineering, and we also engage in expert litigation as an expert consultant for sometimes fairly large claims. One of the threads that I see consistently in the litigation that I'm involved is either low bid on construction without having a properly qualified firm, or low bid on design without having a properly qualified expert, whether it's an engineer or an architect. some of the types of projects that our firm is involved in terms of construction. We did the geotechnical work for the Roseburg High School. It was in excess of a $20 million project. Public agency, we weren't selected by low bid, we were selected by qualifications. In fact, my client called last week with another follow-on project that's somewhat difficult. And I'm certain he didn't check pricing with anyone. He said that he had a serious problem. He knew that I could address it the way that it should be addressed. It's not limited to public agencies. I hear the comment frequently that it needs to be done the same way it's done in private enterprise, where the low price goes. In fact, one of our clients is Roseburg Forest Products, a very large employer, the largest in Douglas County. They don't shop price, they shop qualifications. They need their problem solved immediately and cost effectively, and the cost effectiveness in continues into the construction cost as well. We don't just do large projects. The vast majority of our projects are under $10,000 fees, with many, many under $1,500 or $1,000. We don't compete for those projects on price. We compete on qualifications. I have had a number of clients thank me and say, we wish we knew we could get this kind of service and this, solve these problems before they happen. I'm a firm supporter of qualification-based selection. When I began my employment as Public Works Director for Douglas County, I instituted a QBS process for Douglas County. At the time, Douglas County was engaged in design of a very large dam and hydropower project and a large number of significant highway projects. We picked based on qualifications, then negotiated the price for the design fee. During that time, we had, and it continues today, we had a number of projects that came in under budget, ahead of schedule, zero change order projects. We really focused on the qualifications of the design team. That doesn't mean that we paid a higher price to get that service. In fact, when we did a regression analysis, went back and looked at it, of the qualified firms that submitted proposals, their pricing was virtually identical, within what we'd call a competitive range, within 4 or 5%. I mentioned my experience as a consultant for litigation or structural claims, construction claims. Like I said, the common thread has to do with attempts to, not necessarily attempts to do the project less expensively, but resorting to less qualified firms. One of the recent engagements where we demonstrated the savings that can occur from qualifications-based selections for the city of Roseburg, we were selected several weeks ago. We weren't the lowest design fee for the project. We weren't the highest either. But during our very first meeting, we were able to outline methods for the city could save in excess of $1 million on their construction project. Certainly a significant dividend for selecting based on other than the lowest price. Engineering design fees are typically a very small portion of the construction cost. In our edge of the business, it's about between 8 and 10% of the construction cost. A savings of 10% of the design fee results in typically less than 1% savings on the construction cost. If you consider the change orders that occur during construction, and the standard in the industry is to expect a 5% additive change order to your construction, if you consider that and contrast that with a firm like ours, where our average is less than 1%, I think the qualifications are demonstrated in the bottom line. excuse me, there were... There were three questions, and I didn't get the first one written down very clearly. But remember, one was that the QBS process encouraged lack of competition, and I'm paraphrasing, I may not be paraphrasing adequately. But the fact is that my firm started from scratch in 1995 after leaving Douglas County. We've grown to a position where we employ 25 people today. We practice from Colorado to the east, Texas to the south, and we include California and Oregon. We don't compete based on price. We don't bid projects. But I've never had a client come in and say that they found our fees to be too high. What they've said is that they have enjoyed significant savings on their projects by having a very thorough design. Our firm started out very small. It started out as one man working in a desk with poor wife doing the typing. About as small a firm as you can get. Even at that time, we didn't bid the projects. We competed on qualifications. I don't believe that a QBS process is weighted against small firms. Frankly, I think it's weighted against the larger firms. If someone can refresh my memory on the first comment, I'd address that as well.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shaw,
we caused this trouble. I'm quoting one of the clients, Conforth Consultants. It says, when architectural and engineering services are selected based on low bid, quality suffers and costs rise. And we've seen examples of construction of these bridges in a high school up in my neighborhood where that actually happened. It wasn't to do with architectural engineering, but if you would just address that.
Thank you. We've seen the quality of projects suffer probably as much from low bid construction contractors as from engineers. In fact, during my engagement with Douglas County, we developed a process to select on lowest responsive bid with demonstrated qualifications for the project. And a number of times that resulted in the low bid contractor not being selected. What did happen was during that time we completed the first Douglas County project that anyone could remember ahead of schedule and under budget. In fact, it was almost embarrassing. It was so far ahead of schedule that the client county agency wasn't ready to move in for another month. That's the end of my testimony. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. If not, I'll...
Representative Kibbs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one question that comes to my mind is that in the bidding process, if you were to disclose cost up front, it's not the be-all, end-all for the determining factor in whether or not someone is selected to go forward with the job, whether it's the architectural design portion or the construction portion. I think all things are weighted, and those bids are not shared with one another. Tell me, and if in fact, as you said, they're all within the comparative, I think you stated, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, that they're all within about 5% of each other, relatively speaking. Is that accurate?
For comparably qualified firms, yes.
For comparably qualified firms?
Yes.
Now, then you just spark another question. What defines a comparably qualified firm? Is it size? Is it money they generate? Is it years in business?
No, I think it's more project understanding. Developing a good scope of services as an owner or a government agency is critical, and conveying that scope of services that's necessary is equally critical. Even when that happens, though, not all of the firms that submit proposals are qualified to do that type of project or that specific project. What my statement was that if there's a thorough scope of services and if properly qualified firms compete, that they're all within a competitive range. I don't think properly qualified really is experience-based or how long a company has been in business. It could be educationally based or individual experience.
So there really is no definition then of comparably qualified. I mean, you can't quantify this firm is and this firm isn't, could you?
On a specific project, I certainly could, but as a general term, I couldn't.
That's all for now.
Okay, I guess we're ready for more testimony.
Good morning, Chair Brown and members of the committee. My name is Jory Abrams, and I'm a vice president and regional manager of transportation for CH2M Hill. I'm also a licensed engineer in the states of Oregon and Washington, and I've been in this business for over 28 years. One brief statement about my company, in case you don't know who we are. We were founded in Corvallis in 1946 by three returning World War II veterans and an OSU professor. Since then, we had our offices above the hardware store in downtown Corvallis. Since then, we've grown to a firm of over 14,000 employees, practicing globally. We have over 1,000 employees in the state of Oregon. They're located in our offices in Portland, Salem, and Corvallis. And I can proudly tell you that in 2005, we were named Fortune Magazine's one of America's most admired companies. We were ranked number 3. That's something we're very proud of. You have in your packets from me and from the managers of the Northwest region a letter in support of QBS, and we go into reasons why we believe QBS is best, a best practice, not only in terms of safety, but to total life cycle cost, from competition, to what we believe are some advantages for small and emerging businesses. As a firm with offices all over the United States and frankly the world, we have a lot of experience working in QBS states and frankly some states without QBS. And we find over and over again that states with QBS are better places to work for in our industry, and that our projects are more successful, and that our clients agree. And there are many important reasons for this, but I'd like to just take a moment to talk about two of them. First of all, even simple projects can be fairly complex from an engineering standpoint. They require a good deal of discussion between the owner and the engineer to determine what's required, what's desired. Sometimes those two are different. What's the correct split of work between what they're going to do in-house and what we're going to do, what we're going to do and what our subs might do. In QBS states, these discussions occur before we sit down and write a detailed scope of work and prepare the price for the project. That's a very important thing to happen. If the price that we come up with is higher than the owner either has funds for or even wants to spend, then we work collaboratively with them to reduce our level of effort, reduce the things that they that might have been extras that aren't required for the project. We come to an agreement on what it is that they want and what the price should be. In a low bid selection, or when price is a major factor in deciding who gets the work, then what we've seen is that firms frequently price their work to win the project, because everybody wants to win the project, and then they fight the owner all the way to the completion of the project for extras to make up the skinny bid that they put in. Or, even worse, they deliver a minimal design that may not meet the owner's needs or wishes, and frankly can lead to terribly expensive change orders. No one ends up happy in these situations, but least of all the owner, and in my opinion, everyone, including the public, loses. And this leads to my second point that I'd like to make today, and that is that when you drive the cost of engineering to the very lowest point, I believe that you're stepping over dollars to pick up pennies. And what do I mean by that? Let me give you a simple example, and I'll use some of the numbers that my colleague just used. But engineering design services run somewhere between 8, 12, 15%. Depends on the project and what's included. And that's a percentage of the value of the construction. So, simple math example here. If you have a $1 million construction project, and the engineering costs for that are 10%, that's $100,000. If you low bid this project, you might find some firm who's willing to take on the project for $90,000. That's a savings of 10% or $10,000 to the owners. And at first blush, that sounds like a really great deal. But it doesn't take into account the construction of the project. If in order to get that price down, the design becomes minimal or ill-conceived, then it's not at all unheard of to see change orders on the order of 10% or more, change orders during construction. So that means that you've saved $10,000 up front, but you may easily have cost yourself $100,000 in change orders. So that's what I mean by stepping over dollars to pick up pennies.
Mr. Chair.
Representative, can you give me a layman's example of exactly how that could happen?
Well, okay. How that could happen is someone has to do a minimal design. They've bid the project to save the $10,000 fee. So maybe they don't do as thorough a job of collecting data on utilities. Or they don't do as thorough a job of doing the surveying that needs to be done. Therefore, their design is based on the best information that they have, but they scrimped a little bit to save to get the cost down. When you get into the field and the contractor starts building it, all of a sudden they start finding conflicts and errors. This isn't where we thought it was. The utility is at a different elevation. There's an error somewhere in the plans based on lack of information. Now we have to, the owner, and we have to work with the contractor to come up with costs that were outside of their bid. And those errors may very well be worth 5, 10, 15% of the original bid. And so for want of spending another few thousand dollars to get additional data that would have refined the design, you now end up with large construction costs changes. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Gibbs.
One thing comes to mind. What would happen? I got two questions.
Okay.
Do you have any idea the number of, according to the background of the bill, I'm just looking at the background summary here, and I'll just read it to you. I'm sure you're very familiar with it. The 2001 legislature expanded the QBS requirement to local governments for projects over $400,000 that have at least 35% of their funding from the state. Can you tell me how many state projects there are requiring under $400,000 in construction? Any idea what that number is out there? I mean, I just can't believe it's, I mean, I bet it's single digits. I'm having building codes right now look it up. But I wondered if you have any idea. I mean, I'm buying an 1,800 square foot house, not that it's anybody's business or concern, but that's about $200,000. And I can't imagine the state spending taxpayers' dollars as frugally as they do. I'm just curious what the number, any idea what the number is of projects that are under $400,000?
I have no idea. I can't answer that question. My hunch is that that mostly might relate to smaller governments than the state of Oregon. But I don't know.
Representative Kitts, it says local governments in the summation there. As opposed to state government.
Okay.
And I used to be a city engineer for a very small city in East Multnomah County, and we had very small projects. Sometimes we were just replacing, 400 feet of water line or, adding a sidewalk. So you can have small projects, very small projects, that currently don't fall under the QBS law.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So in summary, in my remarks, I'd like to say, just as you would not select a doctor or a lawyer first by who is the cheapest, I don't think you should do the same thing for engineering. I think you should consider first the professional qualifications of the people that are going to be on the project, their specialized experience, having done that work before, or their technical competence, their ability and their capacity to deliver the project on time and on or under budget, their past performance, and their knowledge of the project and local issues. After you've made that determination, then you should discuss the project and negotiate a fair and reasonable price. When you low bid or have price as a major selection factor, before you have a prior understanding of the scope of the project, I believe you get a mess. You lose collaboration between the owner and the engineer. I think you lose innovation. You lose creativity that could save the owner lots of money during construction down the road. You lose collaboration. I believe you get change orders, both for engineering and construction. I think you get higher maintenance costs, and you get additional owner time managing the contract. One of the things that I didn't say earlier when I was talking about stepping over dollars to pick up pennies was I didn't even figure into that example the impacts to long-term maintenance and operations of a project. So if you have a poor design and you get through the construction unscathed, you still have to live with the results of that project for another 20, 30, or 40 years. And so when you add in the maintenance costs and operational costs, then you really are stepping over pennies to pick up. Stepping over dollars to pick up pennies. So the bill that you're considering, I believe, not only makes sense for a better environment for businesses in the state of Oregon, but I also believe that it makes sense for taxpayers who are paying the bill and for the agencies and the governments who are charged with best managing those precious resources. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify today, and I hope that you support this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I have John O'Shell and Jim Van Dyke?
Chairman Brown, members of the committee, John O'Shell, Association of Oregon Counties, their County Road Program Manager. As most of you know, many years of experience working as a Tillamook County Public Works Director. Little clarity. First of all, we absolutely, completely support the concept that all architect, engineering, surveying services should be qualification selected. Mm-hmm. The concept that we're considering bidding, just not true. I am not aware of any county doing this. If I was aware of any county doing this, I would be coming and talking to them in a hurry. It is not the way to acquire professional services. We are not advocating that. Existing law does not particularly allow that. We are talking about a group of projects. Backing up, the bigger, more complicated projects, we absolutely agree with existing law that says it should be selected without getting price involved at the beginning. We're talking about a small group of projects that tend to be small in nature, tend to be done by small agencies. The large agencies typically don't do these projects by consultants because they have their own staff. So typically we're talking small projects done by small agencies, and we're talking the simple projects. The process, as required by law, they are still required to go out with requests for proposals. That request for proposals is still supposed to have the qualification-based selection is the primary part of the selection process. What it does allow, different than the projects over $400,000, is it allows them to use cost as a factor. Now, what we're talking about is not bidding. That is still a very inappropriate way to do it. We're still talking they need to select a qualified consultant based on the qualifications, and they still need to negotiate out the scope of work to make sure that they get the work done that needs to be done. The difference is we are all aware that there are consultants out there who some of them maybe charge $70 an hour for their work and some of them charge $100 an hour for their work. Now, granted, in some cases, the guy who's charging $100 an hour is more qualified, but perhaps for some of these simple projects, and we believe it to be the case, that a $70 an hour engineer is perfectly adequate to do the work. And we think that for these smaller projects, it is appropriate to be able to use that less expensive per hour person to perform an adequate surface for a less price.
The example that gets bannered around, and I think it's probably a good one to quote, they say, if you go for heart surgery, shouldn't you go to a heart surgeon? Yes. But if you have the flu, you don't go to a heart surgeon. You go to an internist who charges a whole lot less, but is perfectly qualified for the work. We support the existing law. We do have not heard cases of where it has been abused, and we think it is functioning fine. We support the existing law and are opposed to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Van Dyke. I'm an attorney with the City Attorney's Office, and I think I've been asked by the League of Cities down here today to give you kind of the big city perspective on this. I think there's some other folks from smaller communities who can give you their perspective on this as well. I just want to make a couple of points. My workload in the City Attorney's Office, I advise the city on construction matters. I'm very familiar with construction claims, and I advise our Bureau of Purchases, who in the city is the agency responsible for running the process by which we are helping to run the process by which we acquire architects and engineers. We do not acquire architects and engineers through a low bid process. That's just not the way it happens. I'm not sure how it happens in every other community, but this bill, if it's meant to solve a low bid process, that doesn't solve a problem for us because that's not what we're using. We put out a request for proposals and we consider a wide range of factors when selecting architects and engineers, including qualifications, including their approach to the project, and yes, including what they think they're going to spend for doing that. It's just one of the factors that gets taken into account when making that decision, but we do not hire things by low bid. And if I'm mistaken on that, my number is on the sign-in sheet, and I invite any of the architects and engineers to give me a call because I will want to advise my clients in the city not to use that kind of approach, a low bid approach. Secondly, because we are a larger city, we do have some advantages that smaller cities don't have. We have architects on staff. We have engineers on staff. Nonetheless, we still need the assistance of private firms. But I have some pretty sophisticated clients, and they don't pick the architects that sit and select these other architects. The private architects don't do it just based on price. And the engineers that sit on the selection panels when we're hiring engineering firms just don't do it based on price. The other thing that occurs in the city, our city anyway, is that we do try to hire a diverse cross-section of architects and engineers. We get many complaints from the architects, the smaller architects and engineering firms, that we're hiring the same folks over and over again. We try very hard to spread that work around by taking that into account and by trying to foster some emerging small businesses within the city. A qualifications process, I'm sorry, I simply disagree with the previous testimony. It is weighted against the small firms. It is very hard for a smaller, newly established firm to come in and compete against CH2M Hill, who may have done 1,000 similar projects. Under this bill, we have to talk to the, quote, most qualified firm first, and then discuss price, and then go to the next one, and then go to the next one if the price doesn't work out, and then go to the next one. That is not a very good process for us. It creates a lot of bureaucracy, and frankly, we're not as nimble as we'd like to be. And frankly, every time you go down that line, it takes a lot more time to start over, to select somebody, start over. We just want to act like other folks do in private business, which is they consider qualifications. You don't go to a lawyer and just ask what his fee is. You look at the qualifications, but you also talk to the lawyer about the fee the first time out of the box. You know, it's just one of the factors that you take into account. So from our perspective, this is not workable for the city. It creates a lot more bureaucracy. It takes a lot more time, and it solves a problem that frankly, we're not experiencing because we simply don't buy anything by low bid. Thank you.
Thank you. As I heard you right, both you gentlemen agree with the process that's in place there now. Is that right?
Well,
okay, QBS.
I agree that qualifications ought to be considered along with a lot of other factors, including price. My problem with the QBS bill, Chairman, is that qualifications-based selection tells me only to look at qualifications in the first instance and not to consider other factors.
And so you have a problem with the existing statutes also then?
The existing statute does not affect us very much because it only affects us when we're doing a project over $400,000 in which 35% of the money comes from the state. That doesn't affect very many of our projects. So although there has been testimony, written testimony submitted that the local agencies are governed by this already, the truth of the matter is that probably only affects 5% of our projects.
Thank you. Excuse me, I want to get my answer.
Oh, yes, Chairman Brown, all of the larger projects where we can't use price, in fact, we don't have a real concern on that because basically we're tending to working with that first tier, most highly qualified consultant, and we want to be using those folks anyhow. When you talk about the projects under $400,000 that we are currently allowed to use price as a consideration, this law would prevent us from doing that.
But the existing statute is okay?
The existing statute is adequate, yes.
Would you have objection then to removing the sunset so that stays
in place? If you remove the sunset, that would leave existing law out in the future. Frankly, we were planning on coming back and asking for that in 2 years.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. Mr. Van Dyke, in your experience in the City of Salem, in projects that do fall under existing state law and you do have to go through the PQBS system, what has your experience been there? Have you had to go from one to the none? Has that happened, actually happened?
On the times that we've done that, it has slowed down the process some bit, somewhat. Yes, it has.
Chair, follow up. So you've had them come in and you've have not agreed on a price, and you've had to go to the next one, and then the next one, and the next one. That's what's happened?
That's my understanding, but I have to tell you that's based third hand on talking to folks. That hasn't been my direct experience since I don't do that negotiation myself, unless there's a problem and they come to me for legal advice about it.
I'm Representative Shields.
Mr. Van Dyke. Do you know if there are specifically any minority or disadvantaged businesses or firms that might be getting some of this work if the QBS was not in place?
Well, that's what we're trying to do now, is to try to farm out some of this work to emerging small businesses, women-owned businesses, minority businesses, and yes, that is happening now. And the concern of the city folks that I've talked to who asked me to address it here today was that if we are forced to rank candidates solely on the basis of qualifications, that work for those firms will dry up from the city.
Okay. Follow up?
So
there are some specific minority-owned firms and women, any kind of, however you define disadvantaged firms, that could be getting this, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. Then
who makes the decisions on who's qualifying?
Okay. Chairman Brown, members of the committee, the typical process is within the organization there will usually be a two or three or four, sometimes five person committee that will basically joint decide qualifications. Usually they try and find an engineer if they're doing engineering work, a surveyor if they're doing surveying work, but basically it's usually a committee makes a joint decision.
The size of the project could possibly determine whether they were qualified or not, couldn't it?
Certainly on any project, the size of the firm has to be matched to the size of the project. That's part of the issue of why it seems to work for us getting to the smaller emerging businesses. Once you get over $400,000, a two- or three-person firm just isn't going to be qualified to do that anyhow, so it's not an issue that we're not considering them for those projects.
Thank you. Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, John. Now you can head over the mountain, okay?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Could I have Kurt Corey, Martha Moore, and Judy Saborn? Is that... Who wants to start?
I can certainly start, Chair Brown. Chair Brown and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on the merits of QBS as they relate to House Bill 3272 today. By way of introduction, I need to let you know that I'm here in really two capacities today. I am the current secretary of the Oregon chapter of the American Public Works Association, a current member and past chair of APWA's National Engineering and Technology Committee. In the rest of my life, I also serve as the Public Works Director for the City of Eugene. So, if you'd indulge me for just a couple of minutes, we rely heavily on the American Public Works Association for a lot of the work that we do. I don't know that APWA is widely understood, so I would like to start with just a brief history of what APWA is all about. It really started about 110 years ago at the World's Fair in Chicago, where a group of public works professionals got together and were sharing war stories about how things were going in their cities 110 years ago, and determined that they needed to have some type of organization with which to share information and help move along their respective missions in the interest of the public service that they were engaged in. To that end, the first meeting of the American Society of Municipal Improvements was held in 1894. There were 13 cities and a handful of delegates in attendance at that first meeting. By 1895, 1 year later, the group had grown to 150 members representing 70 American cities. And I think it was appropriate what the president, 110 years ago, who happened to be a fellow by the name of George Benzenberg, who was public works director for the city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin at that time, defined the mission of their group as follows. And he said, "The object of our society is to promote the efficiency of public works professionals by gaining from the knowledge and experience of others and by enlightening them that they may be able to avoid the dangers, risks, and errors into which so many have fallen. Instead of blundering along in the old way at great cost to themselves, the cities are sending their delegates here to learn what is best and newest and successful in public works, and they will build their future on the knowledge so obtained. This means, in the first place, economy. Public works will be built in the most economical manner and in the best manner for the health, comfort, and enjoyment of the people." Following 40 years or so of working towards this mission, the American Public Works Association, APWA, was chartered in 1937 and has continued that mission for the past nearly 70 years. Today, with 67 chapters and more than 27,000 members representing all of the United States and Canada, APWA provides a forum for exchanging ideas, improving professional competence, increasing agency performance, and bringing public attention to important public works related topics. APWA has in fact adopted a current mission statement and strategic plan with some specific long-range goals. The goals stipulate that APWA will strive to be the primary gateway resource for education, knowledge exchange, and services, the public policy advocate for the public infrastructure, and to be recognized as the brand name for credible information on public works. And further, APWA's public policy objectives are guided by four principles. The first is support for adequate investment in the public infrastructure. Number two, respect for local authority. Number three, reasonable regulations and protection from unfunded mandates. And number four, support for streamlining government oversight. So that said, it is difficult for me to conceive that we are on different sheets of music here today. As part of APWA's advocacy role, we have adopted a long-standing advocacy position regarding QBS, which states in part, APWA believes the public interest is best served when governmental agencies select architects, engineers, and related professional services and technical consultants for project and studies through QBS procedures. Basing selections on qualifications and competence rather than price fosters greater creativity and flexibility and minimizes the potential for disputes and litigation. Within the information that I've handed out, there is a full copy of APWA's current advocacy statement regarding QPS that is, in fact, reviewed and updated as necessary each year.
As part of its educational mission, APWA has published what we refer to as the Red Book, a copy of which I have here. This document is designed and intended to serve as a resource and to provide guidelines to owners and public agencies on the selection and use of engineers, architects, and professional consultants. This publication has been in use since about 1991. It is currently being redrafted for publication as the third edition. I can tell you it's the all-time best-selling APWA publication on the market. In addition to APWA has worked with its partner agencies, such as the American Institute of Architects, American Council of Engineering Companies, and National Society of Professional Engineers to fund and facilitate a QBS facilitator grant program, purely an educational purpose designed to provide training and education for public agencies, public and private clients. I would note this is, at this point, largely an untapped opportunity in Oregon. And also in your packet, I'm submitting a copy of a letter from the Oregon chapter of APWA acknowledging that legislation intended to advance or support the use of QBS should be supported as a nonpartisan issue. And as you read down the roster on the letter of the current members of the board, you will no doubt note some who may be from agencies who do not, as a matter of policy, subscribe to QBS. As an organization, it is an advocacy role that we play as members. So then the second hat I wear today is as the Public Works Director for the City of Eugene. I've served in that capacity the past 4 years. Prior to that, I worked as the City Engineer and Public Works Director for the City of Billings, Montana. To summarize, I guess I would say I have in excess of 20 years of experience working with the QBS process, including our current practice in Eugene. Not to oversimplify, but in my mind, QBS really amounts to nothing more than considering the qualifications of the professionals you seek to hire before you talk about price. I would also note that over the past 20 years, I have had only two occasions where we were not able to arrive at an agreement with the what we determined to be the best qualified firm subsequent to the QBS process. In my estimation, QBS has continued to meet its stated objective of minimizing disputes and litigation and helps assure that we as public works professionals are delivering projects to the public with the lowest long-term cost. As to just a couple of other points, in Eugene, we regularly utilize the flexibility allowed through QBS to directly appoint consultants for smaller contracts identified as those as under $25,000 of engineering work. This flexibility is currently available, would continue to be available, under the rulemaking authority granted to local governments within the bill. And as a side, it's a flexibility that, in my experience, is available in every other QBS statute that I have looked at. We also use the concept of a pool of qualified consultants for work valued for engineering work valued up to $75,000. In this concept, we establish a pre-qualified list of consultants in various disciplines. We maintain that. We can then go to that pre-qualified list for prompt selection of outside consultants when we have contract work up to $75,000. I have discussed this practice with the sponsors of this bill and received their interpretation assurance that ability to continue with the pooled consultant concept would be able to continue. I would nonetheless recommend in some manner, whether through amendment or some other means, clearly expressing the legislative intent of that particular practice in order to help allay the fears of John Oshel and others who are also our partners with APWA, with whom we simply philosophically disagree on some issues. Finally, I would mention that Eugene's Intergovernmental Relations Committee has reviewed this bill and expressed priority to support for House Bill 3272 with the aforementioned amendment or expression of legislative intent. So I thank you for the opportunity to spend some time with you this morning talking about this, what I consider to be a real interesting issue. Would have the other members here give their testimony or answer questions at any time. Thank you.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Very informative. Can you, when you were talking about qualifications, who determines whether someone is qualified or not?
The short answer is that local agencies have the authority and the ability to define and describe the types of qualifications upon which they will make that decision. And that can vary by community, but there are guidelines available. There are guidelines in the face of the bill, for example. There are additional guidelines in the educational materials that we provide through our organization and other resources available to help make that.
Is there a set qualifications, or is it up to interpretation by every local government out there what exactly qualifications is in this situation?
Representative Kitts, I believe the best answer I could give to that is that it's pretty easy to be objective in outlining the specific qualifications we're looking for. I believe that most consultants would probably not argue that there is some subjectivity as each of those is weighed out.
So, for example, yeah. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Thank you. I appreciate that. For example, if I'm... I'll use a perfect example. If I'm Tom DeLay... If I'm Tom DeLay...
Is he dreamy?
And I have a friend that has a architectural consulting firm, and I'm Tom DeLay, and I call the city and I say, he looks pretty qualified to me. What's to stop that firm or that locality at that point in time from choosing that firm and saying, yeah, they look pretty qualified to me? Because there are no guidelines that are set. They vary from city to city. So Tom DeLay's firm may do great in Texas, but they may not do so great here in Oregon. How is that? I mean, I guess I'm just a little nervous about the ability here, the variance where you don't, it's just simply qualification based, but it's not set in guidelines. There's guidelines, but not set in a finite qualifications that a firm must meet X, Y, Z, A, B, and C, 1, 2, and 3, they are then determined to be a qualified firm for the purpose of this bidding process. Does that raise any red flags to you?
Representative Kitts, let me respond to that by saying that my area of expertise is around the concept of QBS, consultant procurement, and arriving at successful contracts, move public works projects along. There are opportunities elsewhere in state statutes, federal statutes, that I believe in a different way, although not my area of expertise, deal with that issue. Nepotism, fraud in government, other types of criminal behaviors, and not to mention that the groups like ACEC, AIA, and other professional organizations are going to call foul on that if there's a pattern of that begins. I hope it carries some weight to suggest that you simply have to have some faith in local government to make those decisions and be fair, open, and honest in their deliberations. If we're not, people like me get fired. That's the end game.
Mr. Chair, one quick follow-up by Mike.
And for
clarification, and I appreciate Mr. Koba and him and his selective folks that he's chosen to bring here to testify today. I have all the faith in my city administrator from my district who's here to testify right after you. So I just want that for the record. My bigger concern is that it appears, just on the surface, somebody comes in for a bid. There's no guidelines of who can. There are guidelines. I'm sorry, I don't want to say there's no guidelines because there are guidelines. But they're so flexible that it doesn't allow for consistency across the bidding based on qualifications guidelines that have been set. That's my concern, because what could be qualified in North Plains may not be qualified in Eugene. Is that a fair statement?
Representative Kitts, I don't know that I would agree with that at face value. I think North Plains and Eugene are certainly in a position, have the ability, the flexibility to put in place what their respective organizations are going to define as qualifications. So I think if your question is, would a consultant be qualified in one agency versus the other for similar types of projects, I doubt you would find that to be the case. It's not been my experience.
I appreciate your doubting it, but is it possible?
Perhaps if you could share a specific instance as to how that might occur. Nothing comes to my mind as under the guidelines and general theory and concept that we're talking about that would be an outcome.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Holden.
Mr. Chair, sorry, I do want to ask one question. Thank you for traveling here today to testify, Mr. Corey. Would it be fair to say that this QBS system is really up to the contracting agency to set, and it really provides them a tool to make sure they're getting the type of quality and the type of value that they want for their dollar? And not have to rely on the lowest bid, which may not do that?
Representative Coley, that is correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shaw.
More of a comment more than anything. I'm confident whether this is in place
or
not.
You don't rely on the lowest bid.
I'm fairly confident whether this was in place or not. Someone of Mr. DeLay's character could get a good old boy deal whether it's in or not. So I just wanted to clarify that. And for the record, I want to absolutely state my absolute confidence in my wonderful city administrator, who's here as well from the beautiful city of Happy Valley, although we may disagree on this and a few other things in this building this year, but had to get that on the record.
Thank you, Representative. The three professions that we're dealing with, engineering and architecture and land surveying, I think it's spelled out in this here, are fairly exacting science. You know, you can't, if you design a bridge and leave out one prop there, you know, that it's going to come down. And so I think that the latitude that they in the qualifications aren't as great as what you might think. You still have to, when you do the land survey, you got to close the loop when you're coming around a piece of property. So. We're ready for your testimony, ma'am.
Okay. So I'm Jody Seaborn. Good morning, Chair Brown and members of the committee. I'm Jody Seaborn, professional engineer, president and co-owner of Seaborn Engineering in Hood River. We are a small firm, a two-person firm. We established our business in 1996. We're a small, woman-owned civil engineering firm certified in Oregon as a disadvantaged business enterprise, woman's business enterprise, and emerging small business. So I think maybe I can address some of your concerns regarding small businesses and small firms in Oregon in the QBS process. Just a little bit of background about us. We provide engineering services to both public and private sector clients. It's ends up being about a 50-50 split, so we have experience in both areas. We focus primarily on transportation-related projects and infrastructure development more in the private sector, so utilities, drainage, roadways, projects like that. We work on many different types of projects within that area. We right now are just finishing up working for the city of Hood River, developing an engineering standards manual for the city. That was actually, we were actually selected in that process through a QBS selection for where we actually, they had a pre-qualified list that Kurt was discussing where it's shortlisted, you know, under different criteria, up to five firms. And through that process, we ended up doing that project. We design infrastructure improvements for both residential projects. Right now, we're working on a 24-lot residential development for housing people in Hood River. And we recently completed a five-acre industrial park for the port of Hood River, which that was about a $300,000 construction project. So we do a lot of projects in that range of $300,000 construction, which would be less than $400,000 for the overall budget, depending on how much real estate needs to be bought for the project. But so that's the majority of our projects. We also work on some larger projects. I was the design quality control manager for TriMet's IMAX Light Rail project as a subconsultant to a larger firm. And we, through a qualification-based selection process, were selected for two different roadway projects for Clackamas County. It was several years ago, but and that selection, we came in from Hood River and beat out on one of them. I think there were six consultants that proposed, and the other, I think there was eight or nine. And so small firms can compete well and win in qualification-based selection for small projects. I'm a firm supporter of the QBS process for all engineering design, both public and private sector, and support the intent of the this House Bill 3272 and expanding QBS to more projects in Oregon, just because I think it's better for both the civil engineering firms, the owners, and the public sector to use this process versus what I do refer to as the bidding process, which is, anyway, for the owner to find the most qualified firm for their project, the selection must be based on criteria set by the owner. So this is something, Representative Kitts, that you were referring to. And I think that the owner, at the beginning of the project, when they're getting ready to select an engineer, they know the project the best, and they know what they're looking for. They don't always know how to put that down on paper to select the consultant. So the owner at that point doesn't necessarily have enough information to put the detailed scope together to give five engineering firms the exact same scope to then base their fee on. And that's what we found. And I'm going to give you a little bit of our history about bidding private sector projects. But what I think is most important is that the client, the owner, knows their project and knows what they want and can set what I call selection criteria based on their project and what they're looking for. You know, very typically they look for experience of the engineer, which is very important, past projects, managing experience, etc., which you need to have to be qualified in every project. But things like local presence, local experience, you know, I'm not going to be qualified necessarily in Salem on a project as we are in Hood River. So from that perspective, from local experience, Seaborne Engineering is a more qualified firm in Hood River than we would be in Salem. And another statement that I came up with, which I think would be excellent to have in all of the criteria for qualifications, is explain. So an owner will be asking the engineer to explain how you will creatively design this project to most efficiently use the available funds to provide the most value to the owner. So to me, as the owner. So you can do that. I mean, a small firm, I would love to have that question. Because as a small firm, I can bring value based on having lower overhead, et cetera. And a good... If you wanted to talk to someone about that, you could call the City of Hood River Public Works and talk to them about working with us and how we bring value differently than the large firms from Portland could bring value to their project. Now, that's on the smaller projects that are more appropriate for our firm to be working on. So, and that is maybe an example of how qualifications-based selection is more appropriate, and can qualify engineers differently based on geography and experience, et cetera. So, just a little bit of a story. When we were first establishing our firm, we did participate in what I refer to as bidding on private projects. And before we started our firm, both of us had a lot of experience in large transportation projects, a lot of management experience, knew how to put what I call a complete set of plans together to take it all the way through construction, not necessarily just to get the quick local approvals. And as we were putting price proposals together to try to compete with other firms on these smaller projects, we were consistently higher in price, even though our billing rates were lower, and that was because we were putting more effort into the project because we were putting together a complete set of plans. And so the winning cost proposals were usually less expensive, either because the scope of work was underestimated or the scope included engineering for plan approval only and does not include all the details necessary for construction. But in the end, engineering firms, if they're going to stay in business, especially the small ones, we have to be paid for our work. So the engineers end up getting paid the owners end up paying for this extra work either through additional services as out of scope work during the design phase or as changes during construction, which will end up being much more expensive most likely than having engineered the project completely in the beginning. And I just want to, engineering design fees make up approximately 10% of the total project costs, relatively small percent of the budget. I think Jory already addressed this earlier. And just, I think finally here, I think I've said everything I wanted to say. Based on our experiences as a small firm, we no longer participate in bidding projects. We only participate in QBS selected projects. So, if there's any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Martha?
All right. I'm Martha Moore, and should I hand this to her? I've got a little processing there. Thank you. So good morning to the committee and Chairman Brown. I'm Martha Moore. I'm the president and the owner of TW Environmental, Inc., and it's a seven-person environmental engineering consulting firm. I started the company in 1993. I have about 20 years of experience, and I have dual registrations as professional engineer in mechanical and environmental engineering. My company works, as does Jody's, in both private industrial sector and in public sector works. And we have clients in about 8 different states. We've done projects in about 8 to 10 different states, 8 sort of recently. Two projects that we've recently completed that you may be familiar with is that we worked on the environmental baseline studies for the statewide bridge program, replacement program, and we did the noise and air quality analysis for the South Corridor light rail and the mall expansion in Portland. I strongly support qualifications-based selection. Oh, I should go back, although I didn't put it in my written testimony. When I started my firm, we were registered as a woman-owned business, a disadvantaged business, an emerging small business, and since then we have emerged and we're no longer qualified to be an emerging small business, and I have high hopes that at some point I'll no longer be disadvantaged as well. So, but we'll always be a woman-owned business at least. So, I strongly support qualifications-based selection process for all projects in both the public and the private sector. Having had similar experiences to Jody's when I first started my firm, we also no longer participate on bid projects for engineering services. My experience has been that qualifications-based selection really does put the engineer and the owner on the same side of the table trying to solve the problem. And even if you don't come to agreement, I think that I've had experiences where we were not selected because we weren't willing to
take on the project scope as the owner had proposed it. And just an example, this is not a design project, but we had a project where we were proposing to do some work on some environmental auditing work. And the owner had a certain amount of money that they could spend on that project or were willing to spend on that project. And when we discussed the scope, it was very good process. We sat down and we talked about the scope. We were selected on a qualifications basis. And the owner saw that there were all these parts that probably should be done, but didn't want to spend all the money that it would take to do some components of the project. And so at that point, you know, we both agreed that either we needed to hack off part of it and just do the lesser component, or it was going to cost more. And we actually withdrew from the project and felt that we weren't going to do a really high-quality project for them, hacking off that amount of the scope. And they went to the second firm, which was very highly qualified, actually much larger than us. And they did do the smaller scope. And then they hired us back a couple years later, you know, to take care of the rest of it. But so those things can happen in a qualifications-based selection. You can go through the process. And the fact that we didn't end up doing the work, I still feel like we brought value to the process, being able to discuss that with the owner in an open basis where we're both sitting on the same side of the table talking about scope and cost as being tied together. After qualifications where you have good quality people there talking to you. My experience, very few engineering projects are truly simple. The knowledge and the experience of the engineers that are hired to complete a design can make a significant difference in the cost of constructing and maintaining projects, and also in whether or not the project meets the broad variety of public needs that are involved in engineering works. I mean, they're the people that are doing the bridges and the roads and the water treatment plants, so it can be fairly important projects. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Gilman.
All three of you essentially are working with QBS.
Yes.
And you're doing it now without any change in the law. Mm-hmm. My question is, why do we need to bother to put this in?
Well, there's clients that we don't go after projects because price, they just ask for price proposals. Mm-hmm. And so I think that actually what I was trying to explain is I think it brings more value not only to the firms but to the owners is where the value really is. And by actually working together to develop the scope, like Martha was suggesting, the owners end up learning more about their projects and finding out whether or not, you know, they should be advancing this project at this level, or they need to go back and get more funding before they advance it. Or so I think actually those owners that we aren't going after projects or working for would see an advantage, would have an advantage or more value if they actually were working in a QBS process instead.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. We appreciate it. Thank you. Good to have Christy Munson, Don Otterman, and Wanda Kupler.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Christy Munson. I represent the League of Oregon Cities. With me today are Wanda Kupler, the city manager from Happy Valley and a former office administrator for a small engineering firm, and also Don Otterman, city manager for the city of North Plains. And we're going to keep this brief. Really quickly, I wanted to mention a couple things, then I'm going to give it over to the real experts on this issue for whom everybody has expressed faith in, and faith in local government. So here they are. I wanted to very quickly point out that what this bill does is it superimposes a rigid overlay over the decision-making processes of local governments. What it says is that in deciding when you hire an architect, engineer, or land surveyor that you can't consider price on the out front. Let's make that clear. You can consider it later, and my experts will tell you how that affects them on the ground running, but let's make that clear. Right now the law is for contracts over $400,000 or for and that use 35% state funds, you've got to use QBS. Haven't heard any testimony today. We heard a little bit at the end that there's a problem with that law now. As a matter of fact, the proponents of that law got it passed a couple sessions ago, and it sunsets in 2008. We contend that perhaps we should wait and see. Look at what the contracts, what happened with the contracts over 400,000, contracts under 400,000, decide that in 2007. Just something for this committee to consider, another thing to put on the table. And lastly, I'd like to just mention one thing. You've heard some testimony from big cities and counties. We always appreciate their partnership. Small cities have different concerns about this bill, and you'll hear about those. The biggest difference between a small city and a big city is we don't have architectural or engineering staff on small cities. And so those small contracts do need to, we do need to contract for architectural, land surveyor, and engineering services. So those smaller contracts, and when we're talking small, right now it costs my cities about $250,000 to regrade 1 mile of road. We're not talking really big projects. So I just want to frame that for you, what we're talking about. Cost us about $1 million to lay a mile of new arterial. So $250K for about a mile of regrade, $1 million for about arterial. Lastly, I just want to clarify something. You did ask a question about minority-owned businesses. You'll notice in the bill that it allows cities and counties and others to consider whether a business is minority-owned, whether it's familiar with the locale, in determining what is qualified. You should know that my city attorneys tell me, sure, it allows us to consider that, but if you grant contracts based on race, you could get in trouble, or if you go ahead and mix around what your qualifications are depending upon what the contract is. For example, if you change the qualifications for smaller contracts and use different qualifications for larger contracts, you're setting your city up for liability problems. And it's not the way my public works directors want to do business. So with that, I've just set the stage for you, and I'm going to let you talk to the real experts, and we'll be here to answer any questions. Wanda? Oh, I'm sorry, Don.
Thank you, Christy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Don Otterman, City Manager, City of North Plains. For those of you that don't know about North Plains, we are a city of about 1,600 population and have a staff of 12 people. So we are one of the very small communities, one of many small communities in the state of Oregon. The city of North Plains has had what I would call the opportunity to participate in a QBS project. We reconstructed a railroad trestle and used state funding for that project. The project also exceeded $400,000. So under the current regulations, we were required to go through the QBS process. We have a city engineer on contract, and the city, normally what we do is we have the city engineer look at the proposals along with myself and our public works director, and determine not only the best qualified, but also look at the price for the project if it doesn't fall under QBS. In that situation with our project, a different division of our city engineer's company proposed on that project. So we could not use our city engineer to determine qualifications. We could not use our city engineer to determine whether or not the price that we had to negotiate was exorbitant. As it was in some of the testimony today, there was some discussion about that engineering cost should be in the 10 to 15% range of the total project cost. The contract that was agreed upon for that project was approximately 30% of that project cost. We had no way of determining whether or not that was a fair price, whether that was an exorbitant price, whether that was a low price. We had to go by the QBS process. We had to determine the best qualified and then negotiate a contract. And for small cities that don't have the expertise to do that, the QBS process is a real problem. If you have proposals, well, first of all, let me back up. When you get a proposal submitted not under QBS, you can award the contract based upon qualifications and upon price, lowest responsible bidder, not just solely upon price. So let's get that out of, you know, off the table. We're not awarding contracts based upon a lowest bidder. In the situation where there are quotations for prices for the project, the consultants proposing know that that is the case. They're not going to pad their proposals and their price. We're going to get competitive prices for the project. We can then look at the best qualified consultant to do the work at a comparable price. QBS would not allow that. We also, being a small community, QBS adds on paper processing, bureaucracy, things that small cities just don't have the time to deal with. Process would slow down, projects would slow down. Finally, I think that we need to, as Christy said, we need to take a look at the legislation that's in place today and see how it works before we come back and make it final. Because you will have stories like North Plains in a situation where QBS just didn't work. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Schoffer.
And just for your... I'm going to speak for my representative, Kitz, here. 2 years ago, Representative Kitz did a very good job of making sure everyone in this building knew exactly where North Plains was. Just for the record, I think he'd want me to share that with you. And to preface my question, I was on the city council of the beautiful little town of Happy Valley for 4 years. I know exactly the challenges facing small communities and the challenges of providing services with very little and really decreasing money in revenue relative to the growth in population, certainly. My question, though, now you said the engineering component of this contract was 30%, but it says right in the statute if you cannot come to an agreement, you can go to the next person. My question to you, sir, is why didn't you do that?
Because with the expertise that we have with our city, I've been in government quite a long time. Our public works director has expertise only in water, does not have expertise in railroad trestles. We did not know what really a comparable price should be. We were stuck with the situation. We could have gone on to the next consulting firm, but we didn't know whether or not the next consulting firm was going to be higher or lower. We had to take upon faith that they were not proposing to us at a price that was exorbitant. We had nothing to compare it with. You know, our city engineer, you know, a division of his company, was proposing on this project. If we didn't have faith in our city engineer, we should have terminated the agreement with the city engineer if that was the case, which, by the way, we did.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, my name is Wanda Kepler. I'm the city manager for the city of Happy Valley, which, as Representative Schoffer said, we are one of the fastest growing cities in the state of Oregon. We're faced with lots of challenges with growth and all those things that go with it. But first I want to talk about my past life. In my past life, I was, for 24 years, the office manager and vice president for a small civil engineering firm and land surveying firm in Clackamas County. We did a lot of different projects, and part of my job was the responsibility of doing the proposals and bidding on these projects. And I was really nervous about coming today and talking after Christy called and asked me. And so I called some of my friends in the engineering business, and I said, what do you guys think of this? tell me about what's your view of this bill. And there's three different firms that I know from being in the business, and they're small local firms. And the most poignant one was that one of the engineers said, you know, I think this whole thing is going to make us all lazy. We don't have to worry about the cost. He said the big firms, they've got the advertising, they've got the marketing. That's what it's going to come down to. We can't compete. He said, we don't pay our employees the big salaries. You know, we take that money that we make on our projects and give it back in the form of bonuses and do things where they're putting it back into the marketing piece. And he said, how are we going to compete? So there's going to be two sectors. There's going to be those that do public contracts and those that don't. And he said, you know, we've done that. And I know in my past experience, we would actually, you know, bid a job a little bit lower to try and get some experience. How do you get it on your resume that you've worked on public projects if you can't be chosen on the price? If you're an engineer, you've gone through school, you've gone through the licensing, a firm will pick, you know, people to be on their team based on their experience. But if you don't have the past history, how do you fit into that category? And then when I changed and went to the city and became a public employee, I looked at what's cost effective. How do we cost effectively manage the project if we can't see what the bids are? We've done several different projects. We just finished a big road project. All the engineers that bid it were qualified, every single one of them. So you look at their team that they've put together. Do they all have the same qualifications? The answer is yes. They've all done big projects. They've all done projects in transportation. So it gets down to how do we choose? Do you pick them because they've got the fanciest brochure? Do you pick them because they've got the plain Jane proposal and you think it might fit into the plan that you've got, the amount of money that you've got set aside? So it came down to looking at what they were qualified. They're all qualified. So it came to looking at who can do the work for the least amount of cost to us. And our taxpayers expect us to be manage our projects, to do what's best for our city. And it's not always... The most qualified firms sometimes are the biggest firms if you look at their literature, but it doesn't mean that they can do a better job. And I was listening to some of the testimony of people saying, well, you know, they make it up, small firms make it up in change orders and those things as the projects go along. I've been in a small firm. You can't do that or you won't be doing work for very long. Word gets out. People know. People talk. I mean, if a firm did that to me as a city manager and I was looking at what they've done, they kept giving me change orders, I'd be talking to Don, I'd be talking to other people, say, you know, what's the story on this firm? You know, why are they doing this? And word gets out, and they would not be working. That should not be part of the process. I think if they're qualified, they'll bid it. If they're not qualified, they're not going to bid, or you're not going to select them because you know their history. You can read it in their brochures and their pamphlets. So, you know, I just think that the whole bill does not give us much choice. As a small city, we need to be able to look at the cost. We do small projects. It's important to manage our money and be responsible. I need to be able to, when a taxpayer comes into my office and asks me, well, you know, why did you pick this firm? I need to say, well, not only were they qualified, but they gave me the best price. Thank you.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, Ms. Cupler's not near as nervous as I am. and I have to apologize. I have to leave. I'm sorry. But I wanted to stay for that excellent testimony.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, folks, for your testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have Jonathan Stafford and Cindy Roberts. Yeah. Resort. Time is running short.
I know. Mr. Chair, Ms. Atkins, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I'm proud to represent the American Institute of Architects in Oregon. With me today is Jonathan Stafford. He's our president. I think enough has been said here. I had some great testimony. It was fascinating, riveting. Great display of my rhetorical ability, but I think that we'll just skip that for today.
You have it in writing, don't you?
And I will answer a couple questions just very briefly. First concern were raised by both Representative Shields and Representative Kitts having to do with minorities and how you go about figuring out if someone's qualified. as you've been told by both the proponents and opponents of this bill, what makes a person qualified is fully laid out in the bill and can be decided upon, I mean, in the project, and can be decided upon from a local government standpoint. They are the ones who decide who is qualified for what. If it means that they want a minority, they can put that in there. If it means they want you to have had some soil work in their area, they can put that under the list of qualifications. If it means you have to know Tom DeLay, they can put that in the list of qualifications. It is up to the local government. They have all the power to make that decision. Secondly, why do we have to do this? I think Representative Brown, you asked that question. No, it was Representative Gilman. Why do we do this? Why do we even need to do this if people are already doing it? The people who sat before me are evidence of why we need to do it. Not everyone does a project this way. Those who have told you that it works better, but some people still don't do it. I have a list, and I will leave it for you. I was going to run through some of the projects, but I will not. I have a list of projects that were done by city governments in the last 2 years that have won a series of awards. Most of them have to do with the design, dealing with environmental aspects, natural lighting, longevity, sustainability in their products. I have a list of those design awards, and those are examples of why qualification-based selection works. Thus far, I have not seen any examples of qualification-based selection not working or costing more. And then finally, and I did, Representative Shields, I did answer your question while you were gone.
Sorry.
But I'd be happy to give it to you later. Finally, the three questions that Representative Schaffler asked, decreased quality, he had concerns about that statement, that you had decreased quality with low bid. I think we've shown here, and both the opponents and proponents, again, have given evidence of the fact that you do get a higher quality, longer sustaining project if you used qualification-based selection. Second one was that competition will lack. You know, it's not blind as far as the dollar goes. In the end, we're still going to be talking about dollars, so we're still going to be competing. I'm going to give you a very basic example, and it has to do with me. When I was interviewing with the American Institute of Architects, they did, in fact, do QBS. Four of us were interviewed for, the other three were lobbyists in this building who you know and are very well respected and are certainly qualified, probably even more so than I. I was thrown in as the fourth person based on being a woman. So I got to interview, the four of us all interviewed and talked about our ideas, what we wanted to do. None of us talked about price. And I'll tell you what, going in there, I said to myself, if I get this project, I'm not doing it for any less than XYZ. I was positive about that. Well, wouldn't you know, they ranked me first, brought me in, said, we want to work with you, and this is how much we want to pay you. And it was lower than what I wanted. So what did I do? I took the job anyway, because that's how it usually works out to be. The people who are putting out the bid have control over the dollars. They know how much it's going to cost. They know how much they can afford. Not talking about price in the beginning in no way hampers the ability to come to some kind of agreement on price. If it, number one person can't do it, you move to number two. Not number two, number three. Price is involved, so there still is competition. It's just not talked about till later. You let the other issues rise to the top first. Finally, small firms was another question that Representative Schaffler asked. AIA Oregon is made up of 975 architects licensed to practice in the state. The smallest firm is that of one, and the largest one is that of 107, and it's called Ankrum Moisten Architects. Never even heard of them, but they're the largest one in Oregon. So I don't think that being the largest firm in Oregon is getting them more jobs than some of your smaller firms. The average size of an architect firm in Oregon is 5 to 7 employees. My clients would not support, let alone introduce, legislation that sent business to small firms, took business away from small firms, or sent businesses to California and Washington, as you've also heard. So I hope I answered those three questions. I talked really fast. Probably none of you have any idea what I just said, so I'll come and bother you again. And in the meantime, Jonathan Stafford will be just as brief, but a little bit slower.
I'm Jonathan Stafford. My firm is Architect Jonathan Stafford AIA. It consists solely of one person, me. So this morning, since I've been sitting here, the only thing that's working in my office is my answering machine. And we haven't heard a lot from architects, and I like to believe that architecture is a much different different profession than engineering. It involves lots more in terms of human factors and just a much broader range, and you just simply can't write specifications that says this is what we need for our particular building in terms of design. You need to select somebody that you can have a good relationship with, that will work collaboratively with you, and that will take enough care so that the building you end up with will end up having the as far as initial construction budget will allow, will have the lowest overall life cycle cost, especially if you're a public entity. If you're going to just press costs on to future generations, it's not a good thing. So from that standpoint, we the AIA and me personally do support QBS. It's possible for, I believe, reading the bill, for jurisdictions on projects that small firms could handle. I mean, obviously, as a sole practitioner, I'm not qualified for some $20 million project. Well, depending on how much repetition is involved, maybe we could get away with something like that. But I've never done anything that big. But $3-4 million projects, or depending on the nature of the project, or something that I just myself could handle with an assembled team of consultants, which would include varieties of engineers and other people to supply more knowledge than I would personally have. I think Cindy has addressed lots of the questions that have come up. I'm just sitting here listening. I'm sort of surprised at some of the testimony that's in opposition. Didn't seem to have read the bill, all the provisions of the bill, which I can understand because that's, reading that puts you to sleep, and doesn't really understand the value that a QBS system can bring. So I will answer questions if you have any.
Any questions? Representative Holmes.
I just have a very brief one because I want to move on. But
why?
Well, I have to be in Hefner here pretty quick. So, but anyway, I just wanted to make a comment and maybe a question. You raised a point that I don't think, Cindy, that has been made here yet today, that even with the QBS system, if the contracting agency is not happy with the price, they can move on down the line, and once exhausting even those bidders that they're left with, they still have the ability to call that off and rebid to try to accomplish their price. I think that's an important statement that hasn't been made. So,
thank you, Representative.
Chair Gilman, Representative Holby, if I could just respond. If you ask the cities who are here, they will tell you that anytime they're doing a project, they sit down and budget out how much the whole project is going to cost, and they simply write right there what they plan to pay for design. It's not out of the question. It's just not a focus when you talk about QBS.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Could I have Amanda Rich, Ken Armstrong, Laurie Satinsfield, and Jim Green? If I had room for you, Doug, I'd call you up here, too.
Jim's not here, so we might be able to bring Doug up.
Yeah, Mr. Green is not able to join us this morning.
Oh, okay. Doug?
Go ahead. I know your time is extremely short. I'm Ken Armstrong, and I am here representing the Oregon Ports Group. And I guess what I want to say is that I don't understand, and I fundamentally disagree with the premises of this bill. And the premises are that projects are selected on a low bid basis, and because of that, poor projects are getting constructed. That's the premise of this bill. And I disagree with that intensely, because ports, and I can't speak for all sectors of local government, but ports work on a daily basis with contractors, consultants, architects, engineers, surveyors, and have a deep knowledge of how to work with those contractors. And they are not selecting projects based on low bid. I've not heard examples of that being the case. We are needing to move quickly as well as reasonably. The biggest issue for ports is getting jobs in our communities and getting economic investment to happen. If we have to go through the process, as every single one of the proponents of this bill are suggesting, of going down through the list with actually not expressing any concern as to whether that's an issue, in fact it is. Because we need to move quickly on these projects, and if you have to go through the list every time you go, you enter a negotiation with the most qualified consultant and then work your way down the list, I'm not saying it's going to happen every time, because lots of times it is going to happen, you reach agreement with that first consultant. But if you have to work your way down through the list, you lose time. And essentially what these arguments imply is that there's a lack of competence at the local government level. And I disagree with that. We don't have, I'm not hearing complaints about the way the current law is structured. I would be more interested in waiting and seeing how things play out through the sunset of this bill. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues and be able to answer any questions. And also, I did want to pass on that the School Boards Association, who could not be here, wanted to also express their opposition.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
Amanda?
Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'll be brief because partly because I have a cold and I can't talk for very long, but also because of in the interest of time. But I agree with all of what Ken just said. I think that it is a faulty premise to say that just because a selection process considers price in the initial phase, that it excludes quality and experience. And I think that we need to remember that just because we're looking at price doesn't mean we also aren't also considering quality and experience. And I think currently, as the law functions, we allow local governments to use a QBS process under the threshold of $400,000 if they feel it is appropriate. We need to maintain that flexibility because I think there are times when it might be appropriate, but there are times when it simply isn't appropriate and it's not necessary. The districts that I have that are mainly impacted by this, including the port districts, also are the water and sewer districts. And I think if you're there's a difference between designing a water treatment plant versus replacing a section of pipe. And when you're talking about a smaller project and replacing a section of pipe, and again, talking about a special district, that's what they do. They do water, they do sewer, and have tons of experience in this. I think they can write the specs. They know exactly what they need. They know what they want to spend on it. And why would we want to restrict their ability to go out and choose somebody that is offering them the best price and is therefore protecting their ratepayers' dollars? Therefore, I think that we haven't talked a whole lot about it, but maintaining the threshold is really important, and maintaining the ability of those local governments to apply the process when they think it's appropriate, but not when it isn't appropriate for a simple project, is just vitally important for us. And so we're going to be here working toward that end.
Thank you, Amanda. Lori?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, Lori Satinspiel of the Oregon Community College Association, representing 17 community colleges around the state of Oregon. We've had some concerns voiced by our community colleges, several of which are attempting to start capital construction in their areas, one of which, Oregon Coast Community College, Representative Brown in your area, and Representative Gilman Rogue in your area. We're just still trying to get our arms around the impact of quality, choosing someone on quality versus the cost. And so I just needed to voice my concern about that. And that speed for us is also an issue because we have some constraints around timing and how quickly the projects move forward. So I just wanted to let you know that the community colleges potentially have some impact here as well. Thank you.
I think Lori, with the if the Oregon Coast Community College gets the dollars that they hope to get from the state of Oregon, well, they'll fall under existing statutes, so this won't have any effect on it. Doug.
Mr. Chairman, I realize the time is late, and I'll be brief. For the record, I'm Doug Riggs, here representing the Central Oregon Cities organization, which includes Redmond, Sisters, Manders, Prineville, Bend, Mauthin, Culver, and Metolius. I want to make two quick points. First is a personal anecdote. Like many of you, I'm a small businessman, and I've been in business now for 15 months. When I first formed my business in January 2004, I had to acquire a number of things, business cards, printed materials, etc. One of the things that I had to go out and look for was someone to develop a website for me. So I went out and I asked four companies to do bids for me. And I got four bids that came back. Now, if I had only looked at the, if I'd been able to pick my final two based on the most qualified, I would have picked the ones that were $6,300 and $7,500. And then I would have discovered that they were too expensive for my small budget, and I would have had to go back through the process, having taken some number of days, and look at the other two bids that came in, which I did. And I ended up with a website that cost me about $1,500 that perfectly served the needs that I had. Now, the others were far more qualified. They were shops that had been around for a long time. They offer lots of bells and whistles, lots of opportunities for interactive email capacity. But for me, at the stage of my business that I'm in, that didn't make any sense. And so for a small businessman, it made an awful lot more sense for me to consider both qualification and cost up front. And I think that the cities ought to have the same kind of an opportunity. I did want to echo one thing that Ken said, which is, granted, in a QBS system, you can come back if you don't reach agreement on the price at a later point in time, but that's a time-consuming process that adds to the cost, adds to the expense. For my cities, if you look at my small cities, Culver, Metolius, Maupin, they have limited personnel, and going through a two- or three-step process to try to come up with something that's both a quality-based system and a price-based system is difficult. The second point that I wanted to make briefly is that if you look at governments around the state, many, like mine, have people who are city councilors and mayors and even managers who've been business people, and they put on their green eye shades and they do the best job that they can to make sure that they end up with good projects at a good price. Redmond actually last year cut taxes for their citizens while providing better services and more services in a growing area. I think that illustrates the kind of stewardship that you have of tax dollars in the state. And finally, you know, to me, this really makes no more sense than requiring that we consider only the lowest cost bid or the lowest cost bids. Either, in my mind, would be unfair. I go back to what Mr. Miller from AWPA said earlier, which is, quote, I guess you have to have faith in government to do the right thing. That's why we elect local governments. That's why we employ the city managers that you've heard today. And that's what the present system allows us to do. That's the opposite of what this bill would do. So I would argue that we ought to continue to have a balanced and fair approach that's flexible. It's both good enough for business and good enough for government. Thank you very much.
Thank you, folks, for your testimony today. I appreciate it. Thank you. And, committee, with that there, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 30. It's been so long, I forgot what it was. 3272. And thank everybody for their patience with us today. It was a long, long hearing. And my intention as the committee is to form a work group and see if we can get some sort of agreement on the bill. Thank you. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3001. And Representative Holt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if I may just speak from here.
Certainly.
And have the other three people that are on the docket to testify go ahead and come forward.
You bet. We could have, let me see if I find the list here. Lost it. Okay. John Reynolds and Frank, and Nathan Phillips.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say a few brief words. This bill is about a 1% set aside out of public construction dollars for buildings to be dedicated to solar energy design and technologies. And I brought this bill forward thinking that this is a good idea. Solar design has really made tremendous steps in the last decade to the point where it is a cost-effective addition to any building, I believe, and can save the state and local agencies money in the long run. And besides that, I think it also will promote an industry in Oregon which will further provide more jobs and a better economy to the state. I also note that it has a referral to Ways and Means. I think the fiscal impact is yet to really be determined. I would argue that that perhaps it may or may not have a fiscal impact, depending on whether an agency decides to take the 1% out of their current, but what they already have budgeted and shifting money to pay for the solar design instead of adding a 1% to the total cost of a project, that they could figure out how to shift some cost and do this still within a current budget without adding any cost to the local contracting agency. And with that, I appreciate the committee hearing this bill and would like to see it move on. Thank you very much. And
thank you, Representative. I'll let you gentlemen start in whatever order you'd like to do and give your testimony in.
Thank you, Chairman Brown, the committee, for hearing us. I'm Frank Vignola. I have many hats. I'm director of the University of Oregon Solar Energy Center. I'm also on the board of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association and also the National Solar Energy Industries Association. But the hat I'm wearing today is I'm a co-coordinator of the Oregon Million Solar Roofs Coalition, which is sort of a group of everybody in the state coming together and trying to remove barriers to the growth of the solar industry and installing solar in the state. Energy is a very important problem. I won't go into that at this time for time. I just want to give a little status of the solar industry. It's been growing at an annual rate of 30% and has generated $4.7 billion in revenue in 2003, and this growth rate is expected to continue into the next decade. Over the past 2 years, the number of solar businesses in Oregon has grown from 50 to 150. And a few solar manufacturing companies have begun operation here, sort of like PV powered in Bend. And Oregon has a good solar resource. Two-thirds of the state gets as much or more solar radiation than Florida. We tend to think of rainy parts here as not getting much. But even up in Astoria, you get about 60% of the solar radiation you get over in the sunnier parts of states like Redmond. So the solar radiation resource in Oregon is tremendous. And using it on rooftops, you can get about four times the current energy needs of the region if you do that. So it's just a matter of cost and time. Oregon ranks ninth in the nation for solar activities. Oregon has universities with world-recognized leaders in solar energy. And Oregon has easy access to the markets in California and the Pacific Rim. So it's primed to get into the this market, which will eventually be a $1 trillion market. And just as solar energy or energy conservation and energy efficiency industries have grown, Oregon stands a chance to get into the solar industry. Just to get you an idea of what the advantages of putting solar in public buildings are, solar has it would show Oregon's commitment to a growing young solar industry. It creates a stable market for a solar industry, and this is helpful for bringing in solar manufacturers. We had we were just bringing in a manufacturer of solar cells into the state, and because of the shortage of raw materials, they decided to delay their decision for a couple of years, but hopefully we can get them in as that situation happens. Solar cell materials being manufactured or mined in Washington. Putting this in shows the public how solar buildings are properly designed and look and get to see how it operates. In other words, what you're doing by doing this is it puts the payment of energy up front and minimizes the use of energy for the future. And in the long term, these buildings will save money. Not 5 years, but these buildings are going to be up there for a long time. So it is going to save taxpayers money in the long run. It leaves a legacy of well-designed, energy-efficient buildings that are pleasant places to work and visit. It demonstrates government's efforts to provide a clean environment. It would also have the capability of providing security and power backup in times of disaster, emergency, or terrorism. And most importantly, it would mean jobs for Oregonians. I'll be glad to answer questions. Maybe you want to save them for the end.
Yeah, why don't we take all the testimony and then we'll ask the question.
Thank you, Committee and Chairman Brown. I'm John Reynolds. I'm a professor of architecture emeritus at University of Oregon. I'm also on the Energy Trust Board of Directors, and I'm on the Board of Directors of the American Solar Energy Society. I want to make sure that we understand that this idea of solar in buildings is pretty widespread. It ought to be fairly easy to find 1% of your budget when you're talking about daylighting, which is, for example, putting the right windows in the right place at the right size, and going with a dimming system that cuts electric lighting in the presence of daylighting. That's part of what would be included in this bill. Photovoltaic arrays to generate electricity about the cleanest way that we can possibly imagine is a part of this. Solar water heating is another part of this bill. Cooling by using night air across the thermal mass in the building is another part of this bill. So it's pretty easy for me to imagine that 1% of the budget could be going to this, particularly if you earmark it toward proper design of that building in the first place. It's just a whole lot easier to do solar when you're doing it from the beginning than trying to graft it on later. And that's what I think this 1% bill would accomplish. Commercial and institutional buildings in particular really have a high peak load in the summertime. And that's where, you know, when I first moved to Oregon 37 years ago, our winter peaks were our big electrical peaks. Now, the summer peaks equal the winter peaks. And this problem is actually, the summer peaking problem is getting worse and worse. And the beautiful thing about PV cells, photovoltaics, is that they put out most of their output at the very time that the summer peak is occurring. So we can really do some peak load reductions by using PV. And when utilities go to time of day pricing, which tells us, okay, if the utility has to pay a lot more for those summer afternoon kilowatt hours to generate, then we're going to charge the customer more on summer afternoons. This is getting more and more common, and that's exactly when PV on these state-owned buildings or public buildings, that's when PV would be reducing the peak load and therefore significantly reducing their electricity bill. So I think there are a lot of reasons to support this, and I appreciate the chance to come here and testify.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Chairman Brown and members of the committee. My name is Nathan Phillips. I'm the chair of the Oregon Electrical Elevator Board. I'm also governor of the Oregon chapter of NECA, National Electrical Contractors Association, and have been in the electrical construction business for more than 30 years. As an electrical contractor, I was involved in, or have been involved in, many, many energy conservation projects, including most recently I was project manager and contractor for the photovoltaic installation at the Lillis Business School at the University of Oregon, which was at that time the largest PV installation in the Northwest. And that building is a real model of the kinds of energy efficiency opportunities that John was talking about, because I think just about every one of them is incorporated in that project. This proposal is an opportunity for the state to really provide stewardship and leadership in terms of a efficient and cost-effective use of scarce public resources. The largest owners and developers of buildings and facilities and managers of buildings and facilities in the state are the public agencies. There are tens of thousands of square feet of building that the public manages, and the cost of energy in those buildings is going up all the time. And meanwhile, the payback for these solar energy and photovoltaic energy options is going down and approaching 5 years. So this is a great investment opportunity for government. You can invest dollars in these systems, and they'll pay for themselves now over just a very short period of time, and will continue to provide payback for many, many years, for decades to come. One of the great things about photovoltaics and these passive solar things is that they don't wear out. They just pretty much last forever. Another great thing about this concept is that it's an economic development driver. The photovoltaic industry in Oregon is emerging as a national leader. We're seeing photovoltaic manufacturers and installers coming out of Oregon that are really starting to dominate the industry all over the West Coast. As the markets mature, the unit costs lower, and that supports our indigenous industries generating offsetting tax revenue, so that I think, as Representative Holvey said, it's not clear that there is a fiscal impact to this measure. By the time you include the economic growth that it will engender and the cost savings that result from the more efficient buildings, it may actually be a cost-saving measure. Another great thing about this concept, in my view, is that it reduces dependence on increasingly insecure foreign sources of energy. As we all know, if you filled your car up today like I did, energy costs are skyrocketing, and the solar resources is abundant and free and won't go away. Photovoltaics are quickly approaching a critical mass where unit costs will start to fall rapidly, and as that occurs, the incentive to invest in research and development to improve technology goes up, and the unit cost for the products goes down, and it's going to just explode very shortly. And this is a great opportunity to jumpstart that process, put Oregon in a leadership position nationally in the photovoltaics industry, lower costs of owning and operating public buildings, promote economic growth, and be a leader nationally. So there's a lot of good things to say about this, in my view. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. After sitting through 2 hours at QBS, what do you think about QBS?
Well, having been a contractor for 30 years, I have a lot that I can say about that.
is this solar energy design, is this something that the private sector is incorporating into the construction of their buildings?
Yes. In fact, we're working with Ballheiser and Hubbard. They've put in 25 kW in their system, and because they want to get experience with it so they can help their customers. There's about 2 megawatts of solar electric systems in Oregon already. And this is growing really fast, because a few years ago there was very little. It was usually off-grid, but this is now all grid-tied. So Kettle Chips put in over 100 kilowatts of PV on their system. Pepsi in Klamath Falls put in 176 kilowatts worth of PVs on their building. So there is commercial interest in this, and it's growing. They're also talking about the Oregon Health Sciences putting this in one of their new buildings in Portland. And so, yes, it is growing. We also put in, as I say, the University of Oregon Business School put in 46 kilowatts of PVs in their Lillis building complex, along with many other designs. I'd recommend, if you haven't seen it, to go down and visit it. And they're there for sustainable business, and they see this as a business of the future.
Did you have a comment, sir?
Well, I was just going to add that Gerding Edlin, one of the biggest Portland developers, not only on the brewery blocks, but also on the building that Frank mentioned in the South Waterfront, there are 2 projects now with PV. But think bigger than this. We're talking about also solar water heating, daylighting, night flush cooling. I mean, there are a lot of things involved here, and I'd like to make the point again. It's pretty easy for me to imagine 1% of the construction budget being earmarked for this very worthwhile purpose.
Yeah, I did one comment on our summary. Said daylighting is a design that takes advantage of natural light to reduce energy costs for lighting of the building. You know, and that's something I didn't think of. It's I guess that saying where and how and what you place there for to let the light into the building.
Yes, and but you see, if you don't do anything about your electric lighting control system, then what have you gained? Yeah. I mean, what we have gained is a very nice view outside. I mean, we all know what this room is like with those drapes pulled compared to the way they are now. But what really needs to go along with this is that dimming system that really allows you to take advantage of the daylight to save electricity.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Representative Brown, I would just add to your question that between the energy tax credits and utility incentives for offsetting costs of developing new resources, that in my experience of marketing these PV systems to particularly industrial customers who have large rooftops where they have lots of room for arrays, that you're getting paybacks down now in 6 and 7 years, and typically those owners are saying, you get it under 5 years and come back and talk to me. And as this critical mass occurs and the unit costs go down, then we can get to those paybacks, and that's when we really see an explosion of installations.
You're talking about building a building that'll last how many years?
Yeah.
100 years.
Yeah. Payback in 5 years, that's pretty good.
I'd just like to say, I think that these solar things are about where insulation was about 30 or 40 years ago. I bought a home in Eugene that was 50 years old that had no wall insulation whatsoever, and yet it was built in 1950s, fairly modern-looking design. And we all know how important insulation is. I think within not too many more years, we're all going to wonder why everybody wasn't doing this anyway.
Any questions? Don't see any. I guess we've got all the answers we need. Thank you very much.
Chair,
Representative Holdy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add that this bill also provides some latitude for the contracting agency if they feel that it's not appropriate for a given piece of property or a given project, that they can move those dollars into another project in the future. I'm trying to make this so it is easy for the local contracting agency to determine whether it's a cost-effective item for them on a particular project, and if not, that they could use it somewhere else.
Thank you, Mr. Rennie. Thank you, folks, for your testimony.
Thank you.
We have someone here from the Department of Energy, Bill Nesmith.
That's just the first
question. Did you want to just here to answer questions or give testimony?
I'm sure to answer questions if you have any.
Okay, thank you.
Same as
Libby. Libby, do you have any or just here to answer questions?
I have nothing to add. That E-Web supports the bill, and we have a testimony for your records on that.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3001? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3001 and open a work session on House Bill 3001, and we have a -1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I would move the committee adopt the -1 amendments into House Bill 3001.
Representative Holby moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 3001. Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted. Representative Shields.
I would move that we move what bill number?
3001. It goes to Ways and Means.
To Ways and Means with two pass recommendations.
Representative Shields moves House Bill 3001 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Excused. Excused.
Aye.
He's excused.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you, guys. What a marathon. Is there anything else, Janet?
Mr. Chair, 2717 can be carried over to the next meeting for the work session.
And it doesn't take a referral to Ways and Means, right?
Will not take a referral.
Okay. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you, committee.
Yeah. Thanks.
Sorry.